Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. All week long, dueling narratives from Republican and Democratic senators. The country held its collective breath for the results of the FBI's latest review into past conduct by Judge Brett Kavanaugh. And then lawmakers argued over a report that hasn't yet been made public.
An incomplete investigation that was limited.
It's a complete report.
Perhaps by the White House. I don't know.
I'm confident the FBI did a good job.
It was intended to be a cover.
There really isn't anything else.
Judge Kavanaugh should be confirmed on Saturday.
President Trump stoking partisan fires in Minnesota last night, blaming Democrats for the battle over his Supreme Court nominee.
Their rage-fueled resistance is starting to backfire at a level that nobody has ever seen before.
This hour on Point, another monumental year-long week in the news. You can join us on air or online. What will happen as we reach the resolution of the Kavanaugh appointment? How do you want your senator to vote? What will be the ramifications if Kavanaugh joins the court or if he's blocked? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook, of course, at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Jackie Kucinich, Washington Bureau Chief for The Daily Beast. Jackie Kucinich, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me back.
With me here in the studio in New York is Catherine Rampell. She's the Washington Post columnist and covers economics, public policy, politics, culture. Catherine Rampell, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be here.
And of course, from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Jackie, and Catherine.
Jackie, why don't you start us off? Tell us a little bit about what we've learned about the findings of this FBI report, not that we've seen it yet.
Right. I mean, only senators and a select number of staff have seen this report. And what's in it depends on who you talk to. Republicans who were coming out, I was on Capitol Hill yesterday, and most of the Republicans that were coming out of the SCIF, which is a secure room where they were viewing these reports, it wasn't like a cohesive report, right? It was 302s, which are basically interviews that the FBI does for background checks. So they were looking at these transcripts yesterday. And what Republicans were saying was that this is nothing I didn't know. Some said they were even more confident in their decision as they came out. Even Susan Collins, who the senator from Maine, who is going to be a very critical vote going into what we think is Saturday, she said that it looked like it was a thorough investigation. That said, she was poring over these over this decision, you know, pretty much all day yesterday and into today. So Democrats on the other side said this was a calculated investigation to find nothing. They complained that a lot of witnesses put forward by both Christine Blasey Ford's lawyers and some of the other accusers that they weren't even spoken to. And so there really was very much everyone was in their partisan corners again yesterday.
Jackie, I want to play a clip. Speaking on the Senate floor this morning, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Chuck Grassley of Iowa, made a final appeal for Judge Kavanaugh ahead of the full Senate vote.
The FBI confirmed what we Senate investigators already concluded. That is this. There's nothing in the supplemental FBI background investigation report that we didn't already know. These uncorroborated accusations have been unequivocally and repeatedly rejected.
And yet, Catherine Rampell, you know, you've seen a number of Democrats say that they've seen enough. Senator Dianne Feinstein, the ranking Democrat on that committee, said on the floor today, quote, his hostility and belligerence is unbecoming of someone seeking to be elevated to the United States Supreme Court. What do you take from this debate that's broken out, not simply about allegations of the judge's past conduct, but of his demeanor?
I think there are a number of reasons why reasonable people, technically from both parties, should be very skeptical about putting this guy into a lifetime appointment on the highest court of the land. One of which, of course, has to do with accusations related to sexual assault. But his performance during the hearing last week, I think, is very, very troubling for a number of reasons. One has to do with his judicial temperament, which is really the only thing that senators have to go on these days, since judicial nominees refuse to answer any questions about how they would rule on cases future or past. So it's all about judicial temperament. He clearly barked at senators, was openly partisan, things like that. Beyond that, he made a number of comments that people who know him well, people who are friends with him and who were drinking buddies of his back in the day, say were either outright lies or at best misleading. You know, he talked about his drinking behavior, for example.
And you're saying here that he talked about that under oath.
He talked about that under oath, right. And again, like, my feeling is whether he drank to excess in high school and college is not so much relevant in and of itself. There are plenty of people who get sloppy drunk when they're in college, and frequently so, and move on, get their act together, move on, and become productive, successful members of society.
Some of them over the decades of the United States Senate.
Yes. So that in and of itself, I think, should not necessarily be held against him. What is troubling is the fact that he seems to have denied that when he was young and stupid, he was young and stupid, or at least that he was young and drunk. He basically denied the fact that there was any possibility that he ever blacked out, that he had any sort of frequent habit of drinking to excess. And again, friends of his, Republicans, have come out in the media and have said, that's not true. I drank with him frequently. I do not believe that his memories of those years are in any way accurate. So I think that, you know, calls into question his credibility on a number of issues.
Jack Beattie, I want to get into the question of the way in which this nomination fight, and there's, you know, not always but often a fight over such nominations, the way in which that fight's been waged and the tenor of it. During a rally in South Haven, Mississippi on Tuesday, President Trump mocked Christine Blasey Ford. That's, again, the Stanford researcher who accused Judge Kavanaugh of having sexually assaulted her when they were both in high school. Here's what Trump had to say about Ford's testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
How did you get home? I don't remember. How'd you get there? I don't remember. Where is the place? I don't remember. How many years ago was it? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. What neighborhood was it in? I don't know. Where's the house? I don't know. Upstairs, downstairs, where was it? I don't know. But I had one beer. That's the only thing I remember.
Jack Beattie, Judge Kavanaugh, in making his own defense, not only appeared before the committee, but also sat for an interview with Fox News. And then this morning wrote an op-ed in The Wall Street Journal. You know, it's notable that both the Journal and Fox News are controlled and owned by Rupert Murdoch. What do you make of the way in which Kavanaugh is making his case publicly and the president's making the case publicly on his behalf?
Well, for the president, this is really a new low. I mean, on gender, he's a troglodyte. To mock a woman who's gone through something like this, and you know, in her testimony, and by the way, she's the one shining streak of honor in this whole sordid affair. Her standing up, as she said, for out of civic responsibility, it still is what redeems this. This squalid farce, but to see the people in the background in Mississippi, well dressed gentlemen laughing as he was going on, and of course Dr. Ford said what she remembered, what was engraved in her hippocampus, was the laughter of Kavanaugh and his friend, as she alleges, as they were assaulting her, that derisive laughter, and to see it again, she can take comfort though in having stood up for the right.
Jack Beattie, you know, there are, while a lot of Republicans said that Dr. Ford had to be treated respectfully, nonetheless, there are a lot of conservative women who say, you know, Judge Kavanaugh has had incredible allegations levied against him that haven't been proved in any legal sense. And without having to trash her, they can support him. A lot of women don't agree with you on this.
Oh, sure. There's a good piece today pointing out some women in an area of northern New Jersey who are very conflicted about this. And they point, these women in this article, to the summary of the case by Rachel Mitchell, the Arizona prosecutor who did the questioning at the hearing. And she said there, this case is even weaker than a he said, she said case. I do not think a reasonable prosecutor would bring this case based on the evidence before the committee.
Mm-hmm. Jackie Kucinich, there were protests yesterday on Capitol Hill that seemed loud and ringing. How meaningful were they as somebody who's watched the Hill for quite a while?
It's hard to say. I mean, to the extent that the protesters that got in the elevator with Jeff Flake the day of the committee vote, to the extent that they affected him, the woman who went up and talked about her experience and her sexual assault, I think that definitely was a moment. Now, there's nothing wrong with protesting. That's why this country is great. I don't know at this stage of the game how much impact this actually has, other than the fact that a lot of senators, and I've been around for a while up there, I haven't seen so many senators with police escorts that I've seen most in the last couple days. I'm just going in between the office building. But listen, right now on Capitol Hill, passions are very high on both sides. There's it feels very angry up there. And this has been a very dramatic and contentious process. And I'll tell you what, there are a lot of protesters up there today as well. And I'm sure we'll be there tomorrow.
And Jackie, very briefly, in about the next 45 seconds we have left, a very red state senator from the Dakotas just came out today and said she was going to vote against the nomination. She's a red state Democrat up for re-election. Tell us what that signifies to you.
Yeah. So Heidi Heitkamp, who you said North Dakota, is that who you're speaking of? I'm sorry.
Yes, that's exactly
yes.
Right.
Yeah. Heidi Heitkamp, she's a very, very tough re-election in North Dakota. The last poll I saw
very
had her
state.
Down very red state. She was down by double digits. But at the end of the day, what she said is she can't I'm paraphrasing here. She can't have the experiences that she's had. And she is someone who has said she has had Me Too moments. And look at herself in the mirror the next morning and vote for Judge Kavanaugh.
Okay, you're listening to Jackie Kucinich, Jackie, Catherine Rampell, Jack Beatty. We'd like all of you to stick around. We're talking about the week in the news. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the bombshell New York Times expose about President Trump's finances, the administration's new trade deal with Mexico and Canada? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're discussing this week's biggest news, and you can join the conversation, is President Trump's new NAFTA, what he's calling the USMCA, the new fair better deal he's been promising since the campaign. What do you make of the decision by Jeff Bezos, the richest man in America, to ensure that all U.S. Amazon employees are making a minimum wage of $15 an hour? Follow us on the Twitters and the Facebooks at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Jackie Kucinich of the Daily Beast, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, and here in studio with Catherine Rampell of the Washington Post. Catherine, let's take a moment and turn to Trump's taxes. That was a behemoth of a story by
yes.
the New York City Times. taking a look at not just taxes, but really the finances of the president. What did we learn from that, and why do you think it matters?
I think we are all shocked to learn that Donald Trump amassed his major fortune not by the sweat of his brow, but, you know, the old-fashioned way, inheriting the money from his father and then cheating the IRS. I know it's a huge shock to all of us.
Well, you say that, but he's sold a ton of books. He's had a lot of TV shows and whatever.
He's
presented this myth and built this thing on the idea that he's a self-made guy.
He is not. He is absolutely not. He inherited, I think, something like $400 million from his father in today's dollars. If you had put that into the S&P 500, you know, he would have already been a billionaire without having to do anything, a lick of work. He is an incredible self-promoter. I will give him that. That is absolutely true. But if you look at the contents of this monster expose, you see that again and again, this guy who supposedly has the Midas touch, you know, made huge business errors and had to be bailed out by his daddy. This happened repeatedly. This happened with his casinos and this happened with other businesses. So this idea that he has some sort of, you know, special insight into how to run a business or how to cut a deal, I believe he is charming. I believe, you know, and I believe he is probably an effective deal maker in the sense that he can bully people into getting what he wants. But the idea that he is self-made is just bogus.
Just bogus. Well, let's play a little bit of what his press secretary, Sarah Sanders, had to say during a press briefing at the White House on Wednesday. You know, the report had accused the president of questionable tax schemes and, as you say, dodges throughout. Here's what she had to say.
It's a totally false attack based on an old recycled news story. I'm not going to sit and go through every single line of a very boring 14,000-word story. The only thing, I will say one thing the article did get right was that it showed that the president's father actually had a great deal of confidence in him. In fact, the president brought his father into a lot of deals and they made a lot of money together, so much so that his father went on to say that everything he touched turned to gold.
Everything he touched turned to gold. Jack Beatty, when you read that story, if it confirmed things that you already believe or not, what new do you take from having read that piece?
Well, just the dimension of his bogus self-presentation. You know, he was a gilded diaper. He was born in a gilded diaper. You're red diaper babies. He was a gilded diaper baby. And, you know, the one phrase that sticks out is self-made sham. Just the degree of this. And then the point that Catherine made, leaving out questions of legality, which seem to be there, and outright fraud, which there's some evidence of, it's just his upward failures. You know, he would just keep failing and, you know, Plaza Hotel, bust. Trump Airlines, bust. Casinos, fail. In other words, displaying in finance and in business the bad judgment about economic matters that we see as president. And David Farenthold, who's really got the franchise on his taxes until now, points out that just when daddy's you know, contributions were fading out, 2003, 2004, in come the Russian oligarchs to fill the vacuum of daddy. And you know, the two people he'll never say anything against are daddy and Vladimir Putin.
Jackie Kucinich, when you think about this story, one of the things that strikes me is that part of my fascination is that the president didn't release his tax returns, as has been done by nominees of both presidential parties for the last, I think, 40 years. What repercussions, if any, are there likely to be on the Hill from what we've learned, at least this significant glimpse behind the curtains?
Well, yes. I mean, you're one of the biggest takeaways from the story, and this was this point has been made, but that this gives us the best picture of Donald Trump's financial situation in the past that we've had yet. We don't have anything recent. Now, speaking of recent, it really, a lot of this depends on who wins the midterms, because Democrats say both Richard Neal and Senator Ron Wyden, they will be the top of the respective committees in the House and the Senate that could request his tax returns. And both of them came out right away and said, that's what we're going to do. We're going to get his tax returns if the Democrats take over. If they try now, they're going to be told no.
Right. Let's turn now to something that Trump's the president gets to herald as big good news. He is just his administration has just been able to strike a new version of NAFTA, or as he puts it, a brand new deal with our neighbors to the north at Canada, our neighbors to the south in Mexico for this trade deal. On Monday, Trump addressed how his rocky relationship with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau might have affected his ability to complete the deal between the U.S., Mexico and Canada.
We had very strong tensions. It was just an unfair deal, whether it was Mexico or Canada. And now it's a fair deal for everybody. It's a much different deal. It's a brand new deal. It's not NAFTA redone. It's a brand new deal.
Justin Trudeau had his own thoughts during his press conference speaking about the trade pact, and he heralded the deal as a victory for all three countries, saying that North American trade would be in a much more stable place.
It would have to preserve the fundamental principle of the original agreement, which is that when your trading partner is 10 times your size, you need rules. You need a level playing field.
Catherine Rampell, is this a brand new deal?
No.
So why not?
There's some stuff in there that is slightly more protectionist. There's some stuff in there that is slightly more trade liberalizing. But for the most part, this deal looks a lot like the old deal. In fact, it's kind of two trade deals that Trump has previously called the worst trade deals ever smushed together. That is NAFTA and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, which Obama had negotiated with 11 other countries, and Trump immediately pulled us out of as soon as he became president. But yeah, I mean, it's funny. We've spent basically the last year and a half alienating our friends and allies, punishing farmers and manufacturers with rounds of tariffs and counter-tariffs, and busting apart this hard-fought alliance that we had to try to alienate China, and ended up basically in the same place we would have been had we not done any of those things and just proceeded with TPP and more amicably dealt with Canada and Mexico, who were, by the way, quite willing to update NAFTA. They themselves had said many times, both as part of the TPP negotiations and otherwise, that NAFTA was old and needed some modernization. You know, it didn't include like e-commerce and a bunch of things that didn't exist in the early 90s. So we're basically where we would have been had Trump not wrought all of this damage and destruction. So I don't exactly know what the payoff is, we have this long-term damage now to our relationships with our allies. So,
I mean, there has been some praise from even some liberal consumer groups, like a consumer union, I think, praised this. There's some other folks who say there's some things here that are good environmental and labor protections.
That was all in TPP.
So this is all – you're saying that there may have been some benefits to this, but the way you see it is that the cost in our relationship with our trading partners is actually the real harm here.
Yes, I think we did not need to alienate all of these friends and allies who we needed to deal with other major trade problems, i.e. China, which again TPP was designed to try to contain. You know, we've basically I think permanently frayed, or at least have caused long-term scarring to our relationships with these other countries, and have very little to show for it, because most of the things that have been praised by labor groups, by environmental groups and others, were again in a deal that Trump ripped up last year.
Well, and I think what just
go ahead, Jackie.
Just to interject here. I mean, that's right, but I think this is just it goes back to being about the president and being about the rebrand and being about him being able to go on the campaign trail and say promises made, promises kept. And I can't stress
and
enough how much that matters.
He's got more fuel, Jackie Kucinich.
Yes.
Today, the jobs report comes out. The official joblessness rate is at, I think, 3.9%, the lowest.
3.7,
the lowest in almost a half century since the year of my birth, 1969. That's got to be a good economic story to be able to tell, and also good economic status for the country compared to what's been.
Exactly, which is why the fact that his approval ratings are stuck where they are is perplexing, and why it's looking like, I mean, based on what we know right now, that Republicans might not be able to win the House. They should be able to ride this economic wave back into power, and it because of the Trump administration, because of a couple other things, they're really having trouble making that case, even with this trade deal. It hangs in the balance over who controls the House and the Senate next year, because of all the time, the 60 days, all the time it takes to get these things done. It's not going to in the Congress isn't going to be able to address this till 2019. Who knows who's going to be in control?
Go ahead, Catherine.
I just also wanted to point out that even though we have this, you know, tentative deal with Mexico and Canada, there was a lot that was left unresolved that American farmers and manufacturers are still dealing with, because they did not deal with the steel and aluminum tariffs that Trump announced earlier this year that launched a trade war, or trade wars, I should say, multiple fronts of trade wars around the world, and that our farmers and manufacturers are now dealing with the fallout from, both because manufacturers are having to pay higher prices on the stuff that we've put tariffs on, and because there are counter tariffs, there is retaliation from other countries. So Trump may be able to claim that he has negotiated this great deal, which, as I've said, I don't think is really that different from what we had before. But beyond that, the actual pain that has been inflicted in the process of negotiating all of these deals still is very much present. Those farmers, some of them are getting a bailout right now, but they're finding markets closed off to them.
Jack Beatty, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, there is a payoff, though, for the president. He carried Wisconsin in 2016 by 22,000 votes, and he complained that Canada had a 270% tariff on dairy products. He didn't point out, of course, that the U.S. ran a $500 million trade surplus in dairy with Canada. Nevertheless, this gives him a talking point to Wisconsin, and I think that that is one difference between, if you say, this is NAFTA 2.0 plus TPP. Here's one difference, the little gesture to Wisconsin, very important to the president.
Jack, what does it mean for the jobless rate to be at this level currently from your standpoint?
Well, it's good news for people who can perhaps now anticipate a raise, if unless the laws of economics have been repealed. Competition should be among employers should be fiercer, and that should bid up wages. People have been waiting for that for a long time, and we're right at that point where it should be happening. So that would be very good news. On the other hand, what effect is it going to have on the Federal Reserve? I would defer to Catherine on that, but it sounds like this might, you know, hasten efforts to raise interest rates.
Jack Beatty, I also wanted to ask you, Amazon, speaking of the question of possible raises, Amazon's founder and CEO, Jeff Bezos, announced that he would be instituting a $15 an hour minimum wage for all employees of Amazon. What does that strike you? Cynical move? Important moment?
It strikes me as a vindication of Dr. Johnson's observation that where there is shame, there may yet be virtue. He was shamed by Bernie Sanders, much credit to him and others, and he's dealing with a tighter labor market. But the shame, I think, was important. You know, analyses of U.S. inequality point not just to numbers and you know, that sort of thing. They also point to changes in norms that in the past CEOs were shamed in rewarding themselves so munificently as they have been doing. But starting in the 1980s and continuing, shame has been out of the picture. They pile up the salaries without any feeling of public scrutiny or remorse. Maybe this is a slight turning point in those norms.
Mm-hmm. Catherine Rampell, I think we should remind viewers that the Washington Post is personally owned by Jeff Bezos, as I said, the founder of Amazon. That has not in any way, however, discouraged you or colleagues from thinking about these issues. As somebody who studies economics, how important is it that the leader of one of the biggest companies and most influential companies in America has taken this position?
I think there is the possibility that this will put pressure on competitors of Amazon, or at least competitors for the same types of workers who work for Amazon.
So you're thinking Walmart? What do you think
about Walmart or other employers in areas where there are Amazon warehouses, for example, not necessarily companies that are also in retail, but maybe they're also hiring the same kinds of workers with the same kinds of skills. There might be pressure on them to raise wages. I think one important context for all of this that we need to think about is the fact that the last time the federal minimum wage was raised was in 2009. The economy has been growing since then. Unemployment, as we've just discussed, is now at an ultra low 3.7%. So in the absence of a federal wage floor being raised, you would still see pressure on employers to raise wages. And I think that there's a little bit of companies trying to claim credit for being generous and altruistic for raising the wages of their workers. You've seen that from Amazon. You've seen that from Walmart. You've seen that from lots of other firms that hire low-wage workers. But the truth is that probably market pressures would have forced them to raise wages anyway, to some extent, regardless of how much they were being shamed, regardless of the, you know, the sort of social costs of paying workers too little. their reputational cost of paying workers very little, they would probably have to raise wages given the economy, given the fact that they need to hold on to workers in a very tight labor market.
Jackie Kucinich, in the about minute we've got left before this next break, is this does this play into kind of the rhetoric of the Bernie Sanders wing, the progressive ascendant who are trying to gain momentum on Capitol Hill, or is this not really playing into the political world in that way?
No, I think it does, particularly as you have the rise of the more progressive candidates that are most likely going to win, people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York. You know, Bernie Sanders did file a bill against Jeff Bezos because he was saying that Amazon and Walmart and other big companies whose workers are on public assistance, who he says they don't pay enough, pay their workers enough, and in contrast to how much money Jeff Bezos has. So certainly, if the Democrats take over, they're going to find themselves under much more scrutiny. So making these moves now, maybe they hope will stave off some of that.
That's Jackie Kucinich of The Daily Beast. Jackie, Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post, our own Jack Beatty. Please all stick around. We're discussing what feels like another seismic week in the news. You can join the conversation. This fall's midterm elections are closing in on us. What issues do you think are going to drive people to the polls? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik, and we're talking about the week in the news with Jackie Kucinich of The Daily Beast, Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What other stories are on your radar this week? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I think one of the interesting questions that we have is how all these things play out. What are the midterms going to look like? They're just a few weeks away. Jackie Kucinich, as you talk to people on the Hill, what forces do they say are going to be shaping this election?
Well, it's been really interesting the last day or two. You started to hear some nervousness from Democrats on the Hill and elsewhere about how this Kavanaugh confirmation was playing out. Initially, because of all the allegations that were coming forward from women in his past, there was a thought that a vote for Kavanaugh would cause a backlash among women with Republicans. That said, As this has gone on and as so much more has come out, there is a feeling within Republicans, and I don't care what part of the party you're talking about at this point, that he's been under attack, that this has been unfair, and it started to shift against. And it started to, you're starting to see, talking to Republicans in their internal polling, you're starting to see the Republican base wake up and really get back and get engaged and get involved, which is exactly what Democrats do not want. So yesterday, you were hearing from Democrats, okay, let's just get this over with so we can go and start, you know, go back on the campaign trail and refocus people on other issues. Now, will that momentum from the Kavanaugh vote, should he be confirmed today? We do not know that yet. Tomorrow. We do not know that yet, but if he is confirmed, will the anger on the right be able to sustain itself for 5 weeks? I have a hard time believing that just because of how fast the news cycle tends to go.
Catherine Rampell, you know, we have talked about the legacy of Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas and his hearings. He, of course, has been on the bench ever since. Is it your sense that things have changed in any way as a result of these hearings in terms of the conversation about allegations of sexual assault and the way in which they're handled?
I think before the hearings, I would have said that, yes, we take these kinds of accusations much more seriously today in the wake of Me Too, in the wake of greater awareness of the prevalence of problems like sexual harassment and sexual assault.
You mean as a result of Harvey Weinstein? Roger Ailes and all the rest.
Yeah, so many major mm-hmm. figures who have been accused of various kinds of sexual misconduct and have had a fall from grace as a result. And I would add, you know, plenty of others, you know, Bill Cosby amongst others, you know, people who were like beloved figures or very powerful figures
now
at the very
jailed.
Least. Yes, exactly. Who have been punished to some extent for their behavior. That said, the way that these hearings and accusations related to the Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh have shaped up suggests somewhat of a different lesson, which is that it's not so much that people on the left have become more fired up. They were already fired up about issues related to Me Too and sexual misconduct. Instead, you have people on the right more fired up. If you had asked me a month ago whether I thought that having a Supreme Court nominee, a Trump-nominated Supreme Court pick, credibly accused of sexual assault, whether that would be good for Republicans, I would have said no. But that is clearly not the lesson that we have seen. We have seen that the right, as Jackie mentioned, has become much more energized by this fight. The left was already energized, again, before all of this happened on right. these kinds of issues. But now the right is. And if you look at the enthusiasm gap between Democrats and Republicans going into the midterms, it has greatly narrowed. I think that this whole fight has, in fact, been good for Republicans, ironically.
Jack, where do you see this? Do you see this end up playing out in the elections, or do you think that it's going to more likely weigh on what we were talking about earlier about the economy?
I don't know. I think Jackie probably is right about the dynamics that, you know, the Republicans are going to have less to be indignant about. The indignation now will pass to the Democrats. But to get back to this, you know, the whole accusations against Judge Kavanaugh, you know, we saw in 2016 that character didn't matter to Republicans. A group of political scientists who study the presidency panel, I think a couple of hundred of them, last year said that the president was already the worst president in American history. Well, we can't know that, but he's certainly among the worst characters who've been president. His lying, all the stuff with the women and so on, but that doesn't matter to Republicans now. It doesn't
matter.
Do you mean
Republican voters, or do you mean folks in the party, Jack?
I mean Republican voters. They essentially made that decision. That's what Hillary Clinton's campaign was all about. He's a bad man. Look what he's going to do. You can't have what do you tell your daughters about him? It none of that mattered. And it with Kavanaugh, it doesn't matter either.
We're getting some response from people online, listeners who are saying when Sandra asks, do Republicans not remember that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell stalled the nomination of Merrick Garland for 10 months? Where was their outrage about process then? Sounds of crickets chirping. Another says, named Chicken Little, says this has gone long enough, says, how'd you get home? I don't remember, sort of echoing the characterization of President Trump against Dr. Blasey Ford. And Chicken Little ultimately summarizes as saying a person and his family destroyed by the Democratic radicals for no particular reason. Jackie Kucinich, can you set out the map? I mean, obviously the Senate is a tougher hill to climb for the Democrats, but where is it looking likely that Democrats can achieve some gains if they are to indeed achieve their hope of taking over the House?
Oh, wow. All right. So I do not have my map in front of me right now.
If you think of a couple of key races, what ones come to mind?
You know, there are when you talk to the party chairs, which I have, they talk about Republicans talk about several states in Minnesota that they thought are bellwethers. There are two open seats. There are two seats that have current members in them, Paulson and Lewis. Those seats are seats they're watching to see how the tide turns. I think any district where you, I think Texas is going to be very interesting, not necessarily because of the Senate race there, but because of you're seeing record voter registration in Texas, and you're seeing in these House seats where perhaps the turnout that Beto O'Rourke is generating might end up toppling some of these Republicans who have been there for quite a while. We have to wait and see. Again, a month is a lifetime right now in this cycle. But, you know, anywhere where Hillary Clinton won in a Republican seat, keep an eye on those seats. Anywhere where you have, suburban women are going, we're all going to be watching them and what they do in the next month or so, who they're siding with, independents. It's going to be fascinating as to, where we see movement, but certainly suburban districts as well.
Jackie, a lot of you saw a number of Republican retirements in districts, and I think in the Senate level as well, where lawmakers had discomfort with Trump or were being opposed by sort of pro-Trump figures within the party in the primaries. What are you seeing in the general elections? How closely are Republicans tying themselves to the White House or distancing themselves from it?
I think it depends on where you are. But all you need to do, Jeff Flake said this week, I think, and they all blend together, so forgive me if it was Friday of last. But this week, Jeff Flake said that he couldn't have done what he did in that committee with Kavanaugh had he been running for re-election. So there really is a thought, and particularly in places like Arizona, where Republicans don't feel like they can completely separate themselves from the president. Then Florida has been extremely interesting. Rick Scott, who was one of the president's most out there supporters, has taken a step back from the president. You have a House House member there, someone running for a House seat, who decided not, he doesn't want to come to a rally with the president because he doesn't want to be closely tied to him. So I really do think it depends on where you're running, whether you're hugging the president tightly.
Catherine Rampell, are you seeing, much has been made, as was made in 92 after the Clarence Thomas nomination, of the idea this is the year of the women, we're going to see a huge surge. You're hearing a lot of talk about that. Is there some sense that that will actually yield significantly greater number of female lawmakers?
There are certainly a lot more women running in both parties, but primarily the Democratic Party. We've seen a number of women displace male incumbents, for example, or at least win in primaries over men. So certainly there is the possibility that we'll see more women pick up seats in at least in the House and at the state level as well in a number of races around the country. In terms of whether we will see higher turnout amongst female voters, I think that's a very interesting question. There has been this growing gender gap basically since 1980 between men and women over their partisan leanings that basically, like, for example, every time that there's a presidential election, women are more likely to vote for the Democratic candidate than men are, even if both genders vote for one party or the other. And basically, we have seen that gender gap growing since Trump came on the scene, where he has alienated many, many female voters. And the Republican Party seems to have doubled down on that strategy, which is interesting. You would think they'd be a little bit more forward-looking, given that women tend to have higher turnout and the gender gap is growing. And in the wake of the Me Too movement, I don't think people are going to forget the kinds of comments that Trump and other Republican Party members have made about sexual assault victims or alleged sexual assault victims. So, I think you'll see more lawmakers take office. And the question is, will this have some sort of more formative effect on female voters as well, this election as well as going forward?
Jack Beatty, an Obama-appointed federal judge recently blocked the president, the administration, from deporting hundreds of thousands of immigrants who had come here under a program called TPS. And these were folks who'd come from countries like Nicaragua and Haiti. And the judge had some pretty tart words about the motivations that he ascribed to the president. What do you make of that development this week?
Well, it may be good news to people who put down roots in this country and who've made contributions to the country. And the judge did use, as you say, some striking language, talked about racial animus informing the administration's decision. And of course, it's a racial animus of a piece with the president's first words as a candidate. Mexico is sending us rapists and the like. Showing at least there, at least at this level of jurisprudence, that won't pass. On the other hand, the Supreme Court did sort of okay the Muslim, quote-unquote, Muslim ban, because the administration had fudged it so that it wasn't it wasn't exclusively Muslim. So, but it does seem to be a victory, at least for the present, for these people who are you know, as you read about them, these are poignant stories of people who've become Americans in all but name, in all but citizenship.
Jackie Kucinich, how central is the president's and the administration's stance on immigration to his appeal? The president, after all this week, said that even though he's not on the ballot, that the midterms are definitely going to be a referendum on his administration.
I think that's accurate. I mean, historically, the president that is in power doesn't loses seats. The party in power loses seats in the midterm elections. In terms of immigration, it's an issue that really motivates the president's base. It gets Republicans to the polls. And but at the same time, because of the president's language toward immigrants and his policies toward immigrants, you could see more voting in places that maybe places like Texas. I just don't think we know yet. The turnout is changing as we speak.
I just want to offer listeners breaking news. The Senate, even as we speak and are recording this, the Senate is voting to advance the nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. That vote is that it is setting up a full vote of the Senate in coming hours. That was done by a 51-49 vote. At least one Republican, Lisa Murkowski, voted against advancing it. At least one Democrat, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, voted to push the nomination forward for a final vote. That doesn't mean that's exactly how those votes are going to align. But Catherine Rampell, what do you make of this latest news?
It shows that basically the FBI investigation over the last week was a sham to give cover to Republicans.
So that sham?
Yeah, I think it was a sham. I think this was their way of saying, look, we've bent over backwards to investigate these claims and they haven't been corroborated. They've been refuted. They keep on saying that. When, in fact, they did not interview Dr. Ford, they did not interview Kavanaugh, they did not interview dozens of other witnesses who said that they have relevant information for the FBI and have not been able to get in touch through the bureaucracy to provide that information. So it seems like this train is moving forward. And again, the investigation and the brief delay that we saw was really just designed to help legitimize, I think falsely, this vote that's coming up.
Jack Beatty, I'm going to give you the final but short word before the end of our hour here. What does it say that a nomination appears at least quite possibly poised to be approved that would pass on such narrow margins with such an unpopular level of public support for Judge Kavanaugh?
It says that he's going to take the court under a shadow. And as Lawrence Tribe pointed out, and retired Justice John Paul Stevens cited Professor Tribe, it also will cast a shadow on decisions he makes about any liberal cause, any you know, group that has a grievance. And usually the ACLU, whatever it is, brings cases to the court. Those are all going to be under cloud because of the animus that the judge displayed.
And of course, his supporters would say it was the Democrats who fueled the partisan fire. We'll see how this plays out. You've been hearing On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you.
We've also been joined by Jackie Kucinich of the Daily Beast. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And Catherine Rampell, The Washington Post, thanks so much for joining me here in studio.
Ththanks for having me.
Coming up Monday, my colleague and co-host Meghna Chakrabarty will be broadcasting from member station WHYY in Philadelphia. She'll be looking ahead to another big week in the news and report how redistricting in the state's newly created congressional districts could affect the midterms. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Cotsonis, Hillary McQuillan, Allison Poley, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, Kyrie Thompson, and Miriam Wasser. We also have help from Madeline D'Angelo, Justin Dom, and Lexi Peary. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.